So tonight, we've all heard the colloquialism, just let it go. How many times have you wanted to say it to somebody who endlessly complains about something? And you're thinking, and maybe you even say, will you just let it go? Let it go. Or even worse, what if somebody says to you, why don't you just let it go? And what's your response? You don't know what I'm going through. You have no idea. You don't know how hard it is to let this go. And it's said so often that, and even in Dharma books, I decided I wanted to give a talk about it. And I think the issue for us as lay people is, yes, we desperately want to let some things go. You know, those ruminating thoughts, the bad relationship and that you keep thinking about it, the friend who is no longer the friend, whatever it is, it goes on and on. But then there's other things we don't want to let go. You know, our family, our pets, our friends. And yet the teaching is let it go, non-attachment. And I think it's very, very confusing. Actually, this comes up quite a bit in prison sangha, where people are constantly saying, I don't know, I mean, I like my family. I look forward to getting out. I don't want to let it go. So I thought I'd look into it a little bit more from a lay perspective. Buddhism in 2,600 years has changed a lot. As Tony Bernhard gave a talk a couple of weeks ago, a really good talk on, he thought it reminded him, and he's said this many times, as a game of telephone. If you remember telephone, where you would say one thing and a person would pass it on, and by the time it got to the last person, it's nowhere near how it started. And Buddhism has kind of become like that. You know, we say we're studying from the Pali Canon, but we don't even know really what the original teachings were. We do the best we can with what we have now. We've also now, you know, 2,600 years later in Western society, have also secular mindfulness, which also emphasizing letting go of stress, just let it go. And there are techniques for doing that. That is part of Buddhism today as well. So, how do we do all this? What do we let go and what don't we let go? And why not? You know, Ajahn Chah famously said, I'm sure so many of you have heard this, let go a little freedom, let go more freedom, let go completely, complete freedom. What does that mean? I know I, especially when I first started practicing, was completely confused by that. I was married, I had kids. I didn't want to let them go. I couldn't understand freedom by, you know, not being part of their lives. So I'm going to go back a little bit and go into some of the classical teachings before I go any further. So, Upadana in Pali means fuel. And it is when we're letting go, we're cutting off the fuel. Tanha is another word for cutting off wanting things. Tanha means thirst. And in the Sutta Pitaka, the Buddha states there are four types of clinging. Okay, pop quiz. Anybody know what the four types of clinging are? You don't get to say. Rich can't say. Anybody else? Well, attachment, but there's four types of attachment, essentially. No cheating. No looking at Rich and having him give you the answers. Okay, so traditionally, the first one, and it goes from the grossest and obvious to the most subtle. And the first one is sense desire. So all of our senses. In Buddhist practice, we have five senses plus the mind. So six senses. And all of them want to be satisfied. You know, the easiest one is thinking about food. And loving taste, loving the taste of food, and then not stopping when you know you should be stopping. And every other sense desire wants to be satisfied as well. The second one is wrong view, clinging to a wrong view. I think we can all relate to that. The third is clinging to rites and rituals. And I think you can see that too. And the fourth is, and this is the most subtle, and this is why it's in all the lists, it's way at the end, is self-doctrine clinging, meaning clinging to a permanent sense of self, which is actually the core of all of our suffering. So, you know, as I was, I've heard about this list, and it's in various forms. This is just the four forms of clinging. I really saw what the Buddha was saying, that we are going against the stream, because these four forms of clinging actually describe our Western capitalist society. And you look at it, we're encouraged, okay, so sense desires, and I was thinking about 9/11. When 9/11 took place, and everybody was coming together and concerned, and it really felt like a momentous time to be an American, and people around the world were supporting us. And I remember President Bush said, the most patriot thing you can do is go out and buy things. Anybody remember that? Yeah. And I remember being so disappointed, saying, this opportune time, go out and buy things. That's patriotic. This is exactly what the Buddha said is a source of suffering, thinking desire is going to satisfy desire. The next one is view. Our way is the best. It's the best in the world. Everybody should be like us. The third one, regarding rites and rituals, our rules are the best. And that reminds me of the Second Amendment. You know, we've had all this mass carnage happen, and we can't do anything with the Second Amendment. I mean, this is sticking to rites and rituals, to rules. And then the last one, what is the basis of our country? Rugged individualism. The individual. The basis of all suffering. So, classically, back in the Buddha's time, most people were not concerned with non-attachment or just let it go. It wasn't part of lay people's lives. The majority, two-thirds of the Pali Canon, is addressed to monastics and monastic rules. And so lay people were concerned about their families, about supporting parents, taking care of children. In fact, one of the suttas that is best known given to lay people is the Sigalavada Sutta. It's very long. I think, is it in the Digha Nikaya? I don't know either. But it is addressed to lay people, and it's how to run your life. Everything from how to treat your parents, how to treat your teachers, how to save and spend your money. Everything is in there for lay people. And not a lot of emphasis on meditating, nothing about retreats or anything like that. Lay people at that time were to support the monastics, and they were to collect merit by doing that. Well, you can see things have changed. Oh, and also I think this is interesting. I did a paper when I was getting lay ordained as a minister, and it was on how far can a lay person go according to the Pali Canon, especially if their emphasis on the precepts, which is what lay people were supposed to be concentrating on. And there's actually very few instances of lay people back in the day becoming enlightened. If they were, they died almost immediately afterwards, or they had to ordain immediately afterwards. There was supposedly some text that says that they went further, but Bhikkhu Bodhi says, after all his study, there's only one case mentioned in the Pali Canon of a lay person attaining enlightenment. That was Yasa, who ordained shortly thereafter. So, you know, not a whole lot of emphasis on non-attachment. Monastics were told to leave their wives, to leave their children, to give up everything. So non-attachment wasn't just non-attachment with physically, it was mentally, you know, divorce yourself from the world, become homeless. Things changed a lot, you know, since then. And Sarah actually sent me an essay, and it was so interesting, and I actually bought the book that the essay was based on, and it goes into, I think it's called McMindfulness, something, 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 and I can't remember the name of it. But an interesting, it goes into some of the history of what I'm talking about and how things changed. And, you know, we've all heard that Buddhism left India pretty much. And I was always told it was due to the Muslim invaders who wiped out all the monasteries and that kind of thing, which is true, that did happen. But it was also lay people growing tired of not being able to become enlightened and wanting something more. So when Buddhism went to China, the Chinese really didn't have much use for a lot of, you know, people living up in caves. They wanted to actually live these teachings. And so Buddhism started changing and evolving, you know, into more of what we have today. And there's an interesting portion about in Thailand in the 1800s, Thailand apparently was one of the few countries that was not colonized by a European country. But they had a lot of Christian missionaries coming in trying to convert people. And so what they did was they started teaching the lay people the Pali Canon. They started teaching mindfulness and meditation. And this kept that country from being converted over to Christianity. And that's when things really started changing. And that was like 150, 200 years ago. So, and now we've seen it really changed as it's come to the U.S. We're taking on a lot of what was before monastic practices. I think most of us, or many of us, have gone on retreats. That didn't happen. We have a, many of us have a daily meditation practice. I won't ask who, I won't ask you to raise your hands. But most of us do have a daily meditation practice. And that has led to, I think, some confusion about letting go. You know, we're kind of a hybrid now. Practicing, spending time in monasteries, a lot of us go on monastic retreats. We do let go for a while, you know, of everything and get a lot out of it and really see the benefit of it. But we come back. You know, we come back to our families, our friends, our pets, our homes. So the question comes up, what does it mean to just let it go in 21st century America? How do we do that? Are we supposed to detach from our loved ones? And how can we detach from causes that really need our input that we should be involved in? So when I bring this up at prison, one inmate had said to me, literally, I don't want to be a zombie. And I think you can kind of understand what he means. This particular person had spent a lot of time in solitary confinement and lost everything and didn't like it, didn't think non-attachment was the best thing in the world. And didn't want to be there, wanted to be connected, wanted to have a family, wanted to have a home, wanted all those things. So how do we do that? And what does this really mean? So how do we hold on to the beings we love but still practice this just let it go? And I think we have to look at right view. And right view, in the short version, is we don't cling to a view, and that means a view about our loved ones. When we're clinging and we're attaching to people, it's our view of them, it's not them. They, like us, are constantly changing, continually changing. I know there's some therapists in this room, probably quite a few therapists in this room, and I would imagine if you speak to married couples and they're having problems, one of them would be saying, this isn't the person I married. They're completely different. This isn't what I expected. And maybe you've said that to yourself, if you're being honest about a partner. Well, of course they're not. You know, just like you, they are constantly changing due to causes and conditions, due to their own life experience. And if we can start seeing them as impermanent as everything else and as changing and evolving as life happens, we can start detaching from that view. We can start seeing them for what they are. And when we begin to see that we're attached to a view of them and not to them themselves, it completely changes our perspective. I've been reflecting on this a lot because, as some of you know, I've got a 16-year-old dog that's close to the end. And I was kind of walking her the other day. She doesn't walk very well anymore. And it's so much easier with an animal because she is not the dog I had 15 years ago. She's just not. She is an old senior dog who will be dying soon. That's how I see her. not as, gee, I wish he was this other way. No, that's not possible. Yet we do that to our loved ones. You know, and maybe it's because so much of us is wrapped up in them, the fourth area of clinging. Our own egos are wrapped up in that. And so how they respond, how they act is a reflection on us. It's easier with animals, different species, I guess. Even clinging to something like rites and rituals, and today, I think some of you know Karen Jacques, who's a regular here and was hit by, she and her husband were hit by, in their car by a drunk driver. And Karen has been in and out of the hospital frequently, and she just had another operation, so I went to see her. And I was talking a little bit about this topic. We had a really interesting conversation, and we were talking about the precepts, the five training precepts. Anybody want to name the five training precepts? No, Rich. Anybody else want to name the five training precepts? Okay, Michael?
Non-killing.
Uh-huh.
Non-stealing.
Uh-huh.
No sexual misconduct.
Right.
And then there's the right, the wise speech part. And then there's sensual abuse.
Right.
Over unhealthy sexual, unsensual, not just sexual.
Right, right. Intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. Yeah. So, you know, these are our sila practice or virtuous conduct practice. Yet they are not to be clung to either. So when I was talking to Karen today, and we were talking about this, she said, yeah, I wish somebody had taken the keys from that drunken driver before they hit us. So if you stuck to them absolutely exactly, you know, it just becomes the Ten Commandments and follow it no matter what. They are flexible. You know, this is why we're practicing, so we can see each situation as it arises. They're a guide, they're a path, but it doesn't mean they are to be followed to the T all the time. So even that has to be let go. So how do we do that? How do we release and let it go? Well, I'll tell you one thing. Don't stick to just one method for letting go. Don't attach to one method of letting go. The Buddha himself had said that there's 40 different meditation types. You know, I've talked to some of the nuns about this and asked them, do you offer different meditation for different people? And they said, yeah, absolutely. If you've heard of the Buddhist personality types, they use those. You know, if you're a greed type or if you're a deluded type or, you know, whatever it is, a certain meditation is best for you. So you don't cling to any one that works. But from a very lay point of view, sometimes letting go is doing our practice just like we do. But then if there's emotions such as grief, often sitting in meditation doesn't work. I can vouch for that. And as I mentioned before, my teacher had told me, I want you to go out and walk every day. Just walk. Walk. Do it mindfully, but walk. Keep the body moving. Judgment issues, you know, things that are going on with your life about what do? Talk to a good friend, a spiritual friend, instead of ruminating about it. This is why we have Kalyanamita groups. You have Kalyanamita friends, which means a good friend. The Buddha himself said, I am a Kalyanamita. I'm your good friend. And then for really difficult situations, you know, we have group discussions. You know, in the young people's group, we'll bring up situations and everybody breaks up into smaller groups and discuss. How are you going to deal with, you know, this particular situation? And then how do we hold on to causes we do believe in? And this gets me back to climate change. You know, the Climate Change Sangha sent in a list of proposals to the Sacramento Dharma Center. We're asking all teachers to mention climate change because it is the most important issue of our time. And people don't want to get involved. Why do you think? Why don't they want to get involved? Huh?
Because they're attached to their things, their paper products.
That is a really good point. I hadn't even thought of that one. That is a really good point. Yeah, you're probably right. Don't want to change their lifestyle and don't want to feel, have somebody, yeah, chastising them.
I think it's just so overwhelming.
Yeah, that's what I think too.
It's just so overwhelming. I think people end up in paralysis too.
Exactly. I agree with you, Margaret. At least, you know, when we've talked about it and tried to encourage people to get involved, it's, I don't want to deal with that. It's depressing. There's nothing I can do. The world's on fire. That's it. You know, I'm not going to deal with it. But actually, internally, you are dealing with it. And so what the Buddha had suggested is anything like this, any cause that you subscribe to, but you're worried it's not going to work out, you have to let go of results. That's it. Let go of results. You don't know ultimately what's going to happen. And of anything, none of us do. So Joanna Macy said, action alleviates anxiety. And it does. You know, I was in deep despair too, and then when Susan Orr and I started the Climate Sangha in a precept class, it felt so much better. Just doing something. I don't know if it's going to make a difference, but doing something just felt right. You know, when people go into prison, when I'm training volunteers, one of the first things I'll tell them is, you're not saving anybody. Don't even go in thinking you're going to save somebody. Because a lot of people do, and if I can't save somebody, what am I doing? Well, you're doing what you can. That's it. And who knows who's going to be helped and who isn't going to be helped. I was in prison this past Tuesday night, and because of a lockdown and situation, there was only 4 people. Usually we have about 18 or 19. And I was speaking to this one person who's been coming for quite a while, and he said, you know Oscar? You remember Oscar Rodriguez? I said, yeah, I write to him. He was transferred to Wasco. Oscar is one of the most devoted people that I'd met. In fact, when Rich and Matt were, Boogie, when you and Boogie were doing your devotional thing, I was thinking of Oscar because he's very much into devotion. And this guy said to me, you know, before he came to the Sangha, was in solitaire for 20 years. Who would think he would change? You know, who would think it? I had no idea. This is one of the kindest people I've ever met. He's, in fact, he's going to be released in October. He's in Wasco right now. And I said, you are kidding. He was? He said, yeah. He said the practice changed him that much. He's completely into devotion now. You just don't know. You don't know what is going to happen. So what works in both instances, letting go and not letting go? And this is tried and true, and I give a talk on this once a year. Do you know what it is? You can't even guess, huh? Maranasati. Maranasati is mindfulness of death. And that puts things in perspective. You want to hold on to judgments and ill will. You know, put it into the perspective of this life is short. We're all born with a terminal illness called birth. And until we start seeing that and we can start using that as our perspective, we're going to be attached constantly. I've got, fortunately, my family doesn't listen to my talks, so I can talk about them a lot. I dread if they ever decided to, but I've got two stepdaughters who I'm very close to. I've mentioned them a few times. And they have not been speaking to each other since last November. And they live 10 miles apart. And it was all because of a disagreement about how Christmas presents should be given. It started out with this, you know, this little thing, and then it turned into harsh words, and then it turned into Facebook postings about each other, and now it is just ridiculous. Ridiculous. And I'm caught in the middle frequently. You favor her, no, you favor her, that kind of thing. And I wonder if they actually would be acting this way if they knew one of them was terminally ill. And they knew this person didn't have long to live. I really wonder about that. And I think I'm going to bring it up to them. I don't know if it will work, but I think it's something to consider. So when you work with Maranasati, mindfulness of death, this is when you forgive. This is when you can drop. You don't have to attach anymore. The important things start coming up. And the important things are compassion and love for each other. That's what happens. Anybody who has spent time with the dying, and I know many of you have, and I certainly have, it's just love and compassion that comes up, wanting to clear things. Do it now. You know, don't hold on. That's letting it go. Just let it go. So the power of letting go, what happens? I think every one of you has experienced it for short periods of time. I think completely letting go, you know, you're enlightened. But we've had short periods, and it could be on retreat. You know, those of you who have gone on retreat and just had that, just letting everything, put it down, you know, as a lot of people describe it. Or Terry here walks out in nature and talks about how just liberating that is. There's so many different ways of experiencing letting it go. And when you're able to let it go, you will see life without distortion. That view, you know, the second of the attachments is gone. you can start seeing things clearly. You might even get a better nature of your own true nature. And your own true nature is kindness and compassion. The Buddha had said, we cover it up with all of our stories, with all of our judgments. And when we have time to let it fall away, we find we are compassionate, kind to people. Yeah. So try that out. Letting it go means you'll be able to gain the ability to change without sinking into depression. You'll go through grief, guarantee, but grief is not depression. Grief is a normal human response to loss, to sadness. That happens. I know one of my favorite reflections, which I use a lot, is it's like this now. It's like this now. And that's it. It's a passing state. It's appropriate for right now, but it's passing. And then you will find what the Buddha calls unconditioned joy, joy that comes from nothing, just an open heart. It's not conditioned on anything. It's just a freedom that takes place. And this can happen when you can start just letting it go. So that's all I have to say tonight. If anybody has, you know, I did want to hear, I had a question, where did I put it? What has worked for you? You know, when you have really wanted to let something go, you needed to. What method worked for you when you were working with that? Yeah. Pardon me? Curiosity and humor. Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Acknowledgement of whatever it is I'm trying to let go.
Okay.
Never going to be able to let it go.
Yeah, well, that is actually the first practice, too, is investigation. You know, actually seeing it for what it is, feeling it in the body and the mind. Yeah. So if you don't acknowledge, it gets just buried deeper and deeper. Yeah.
Also, an act of compassion towards that object.
Exactly. Great. Thank you. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Laura.
I find that if I'm really finding myself overly attached to an outcome, either for myself or somebody else, for somebody, you know, and I find myself escalating, and I can feel the emotion escalating more and more and more. That you know, it used to be that was driving me, and that would be what would move me forward is that emotion, you know, and I would think that's how I could accomplish something. To change something for somebody else, or to change, and I can only change things for myself, or to change things for myself. But I find that if I let go of that, if I step back from that emotional state and let that go, that ultimately I act with more compassion in the long run. That I'm not attached to outcomes. Mm. Things become a lot clearer for me, and I can. It's much easier.
Yeah.
Easier.
Yeah. Not clinging to outcomes is a huge practice in itself, and just doing what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's. Don't emotions drive you and driving you into a. We all have emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that drive you to accomplish things? Because it does for me. I mean, I don't try to get rid of my emotions. I like them. It makes me who
to a purpose, that an outcome that I want. So I don't want to let it go.
We all have emotions. You know, we're human beings. Emotions are part of our makeup. It's when we start suffering from emotions that we have to start looking at it and what is happening? Why am I succumbing to this? Because it's great when we have positive emotions like you're talking about. That's wonderful, and it's invigorating, and it keeps you going and creative. But then when we have grief and despair, you know, what do we do with those? And I think that's what this practice is about, not clinging to thinking it's always going to be wonderful and uplifting. Sometimes it isn't, because that's life, you know? It's a balancing act, constantly. Yeah, Michael?
I think sometimes if you can get, somehow if you get a clear view of how much suffering this is causing you by whatever you're doing, it's a really strong motivation to, well, I don't understand really what's going on, but I just know that this is really toxic for me, so I've got
exactly.
to somehow do something different with it.
Exactly.
It kind of clears out the whole analytical part.
Right. And that's why there's all different ways of dealing with different emotions, and you have to find out what works for you, and what works for Rich or Terry might not work for you. It's that's why you have a teacher too, you know, who can look at the situation in you and give you some advice. Yeah, Sarah.
I find one thing that's really helpful, you were talking about the letting go of self, sense of self, and if I'm really ruminating a lot or you know, whatever's going on that I'm gonna call up in myself, like taking a walk in nature, and I'll find myself like walking, and the first half of the walk I'll still be totally caught up in myself, and then sometimes like I'll see a bird or I'll see a rabbit or I'll just see the sky and I'll be able to like let go and focus in on myself and just take in through my senses all the things that are around me, and that really helps my perspective. It doesn't always last, you know, all day long, but it definitely gives me like a little break and lets me see that there's like all this beauty and other things out there besides just whatever it is that's going on internally.
Yeah. Then you can say it's like this now, and know this too will change. One of the things I forgot to say also, when I'm mentoring people, I will often ask them to be of service to someone else or to something else or a cause, something they're passionate about. Because the sense of self then takes a background when you're concerned with another being. Yeah.
With certain situations, sort of like what Michael said, when you realize that it's toxic, that it's, but where I'm really stuck and I can't seem to let go, then I have found if I set for myself the intention every time I recognize it, say, I am going to let this go. And I don't necessarily then, but I am constantly repeating to myself that I will find that way. And on an unconscious level, it begins to dissipate. It's not through the intellect, it's through thinking about the facts of the case. It's just, I am going to.
Right. Yeah.
Over again.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Yeah, John.
So when I get caught up, usually in some, what I think is a negative, you know, emotional state, usually something around judgment, I'll recognize it, and then what really helps me almost immediately is to think about make an inquiry, what am I feeling in my body? Where am I feeling this right now? And that kind of shuts off the mental stuff, because now I'm focused on the bodily sensations, and then I can watch those change, and before I know it, that whatever the issue was, it's, you know, oh, I'll let that go.
Right, right.
So if I find that I've got a really strong reaction, it helps me just focus on that bodily sensation to really.
Yeah, great, thank you. Yeah, Vicki.
I found that that meta practice really helps me move things or get out of like too much emotion or, I mean, the nature part I love too, but when I do it for myself and I do it for the person or thing that is, well, the person usually, that I'm having the difficulty with. And that helps me let it go.
Yeah, yeah. The antidote for anger is metta. So, thank you. Anybody else have anything? All right, then you all get to go home early. All right, so just do a final dedication of merit. So may our practice here tonight be of benefit to all of us here. May we take the lessons that we've learned from each other and utilize them in our lives. And may we have compassion and patience for ourselves and for the difficult situations we might find ourselves in. This is just the way it is now. And may each of us in this room, and may all beings fully awakened and know complete unconditioned happiness. So thank you all for coming.